session number 31509, rule 3.
So you settled very happily, did you, into your regiment? Your
Yes, I did. It was a bit of a lottery. I didn't know anything about the regiment. Of course, when I say we didn't know, that's not quite correct. The object of going up and seeing the CO was to be seen by him. It was also for you to see something of the officers and the regiment itself. And if you thought, I don't think I'd fit in here, you could always change if you wanted to. But that was a little difficult. The die was usually cast. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky because with the Norfolks in Jhansi, which is right in the centre of India, there was a very good Indian cavalry regiment there called the Pune Horse. And with delightful officers in it, marvellous people, some of them great senses of humour and that sort of thing. And it gave me an insight into what life in an Indian cavalry regiment would be like. I didn't want to go into the Pune Horse myself. I wanted to go into one or two of the others, which were famous and very popular. Everybody wanted to get into them. And I didn't get my first choice, but I got my second choice, which was the 15th Lancers. And in the time that I was with them, which was only a short time for reasons I'll explain, we won not only the Indian Cavalry tournament against the other 20 regiments, but we also won the interregimental, beating all the English cavalry regiments, who had more money than us and could spend more money on good ponies. But it came down to having good ponies and powerful, strong hitters and tacticians to win a game like that. And the 15th Lancers were real specialists. The CO was a man called Joey Atkinson at the time, and he had led the British team against the Americans in America at, I'll think of the name of it, before the war. He was a very high handicap player. And of course, it was his push that got us to win these other tournaments. Unfortunately, when I knew him, he was badly incommoded with what we thought was gout or whatever. And he was very stiff. And afterwards, it was realized that he'd been going through an attack of polio, which had curtailed the full movement of all his limbs. But very little was known about polio in those days. A junior officer, John Conway, who joined at the same time as I did from Calcutta, where he'd done his year with the Black Watch, he was only with us for about 2 months. He and I used to go practice sword and lance drill under tuition on the hottest of days, and it took an awful lot out of him, and he got very run down, and we sent him up to the hills to cold climate to recover. And unfortunately, either on the way up or the way down and traveling a bus, he picked up polio. He came back. He wasn't back for more than 3 or 4 days when he was rushed off to hospital. I went to see him as a brother officer about the second day, and I asked at the desk where I would find John Conway, and they said, take that passage and you'll find a room on the left. And I went down to see him, and he was paralytic in bed. I said, "Hello, John, how are you?" And he looked at me, and we had a little conversation, but it took him half a minute sometimes to answer my question. He was trying to work out to say it, and when he was going through his mind, his brain was already badly affected. And within 3 or 4 days, he was dead. And then we learned that he had had poliomyelitis, and I'd been allowed to go in there and talk to him. Anyway, I didn't pick up the bug, thank goodness. I probably wouldn't be here, and I wasn't run down. It sort of thing. Like most oriental diseases, if you're run down, and you're more liable to pick them up than if you're healthy.
How were you taking to Indian society? You know, the British Raj time. This would have been sort of coming to the tail end, wouldn't it? but I imagine still going, you know, that there were still the traditions there. I wonder if you could tell me what it was like to be a young officer in India at that time.
Well, from a sports point of view, of course, it was one of the most wonderful places in the world. Politically, the army was not at all political. Political subjects were barred from the mess and private conversation. There were three shibboleths in the mess: you do not talk politics, you do not talk about money, and you do not talk about women. And if any of these subjects came up accidentally, it was immediately drinks all around, which could be very expensive. We, of course, saw a lot of the troubles that were going on in India, but they didn't affect us. It was all squabbles between the Mohammedans and the Hindus in the middle and north of India. The Hindus would be outraged because Muhammad had been seen to kick a cow that was in the way, or something of that sort. Insults were traded, and Muhammadans would be insulted if they, to get their own back, the Hindus drove a pig into one of their mosques, the pig being considered the foulest animal in the world. And they'd get so excited, very quick to get anger, and they'd lose all sense of control. And the army, we used to have to go in and separate them and keep the peace. That was an extraordinary thing, but that was amongst all over India. And they come out when there are troubles. You still read about them. They're called Gundas. In this country, I suppose, the scum that live in the cities, pardon the expression that I used just now, but when anything goes wrong, they're out to loot and do things like that and take advantage of the situation. And of course, in India, that element of the bazaar, they were not just people without things. They were criminally minded. Any way they could get anything, they weren't going to work for it, was to steal it.
How about the independence movement at that time, and Gandhi in particular? You know, did you know much? Did you hear much about that?
Oh, yes. There was no television, of course, in those days, and the radio was there, but there were excellent papers, newspapers. The Statesman, particularly out north, and Civil and Military Gazette, which was printed in Horn, which, of course, Rudyard Kipling had connections with when he was out there. They were excellent papers. They told one. They reported faithfully everything about politics and other things as well that were of interest to one in India. We knew all about that. But we did not get involved.
Well, and that was policy, was it?
That was policy.
I believe you did once visit Gandhi, though.
Oh, I visited him many years later when I was an ADC. Well, not many years, but quite a few years later when I was an ADC to the Governor of Madras. The inspiration for this is it was actually Sidney Cuthbert, who was in the Scots Guards and who was a fellow ADC. He said he wanted to go and meet Gandhi. He'd been to Eton himself. His father was killed in the Great War, and his stepfather, Lord Reedsdale, and he was always interested in that sort of thing. I was much more practical. But I said, Sidney, I'd love to come up with you and visit Gandhi. It was out of curiosity more than anything else. But we both spent a whole hour with him, and it may seem extraordinary because ordinary, he wouldn't see people in the ordinary way, especially Brits and ourselves. The chief minister in Madras was a man called Sri Radha Gopalacharya, whose son was married to, I think his, I forget which way it was, son was married to one of and his daughters or vice versa. And I, incidentally, I do know who that is if I look it up. That's in my notes. Anyway, he wrote a note to his to Gandhi, and saying that we were coming up, and well, because of their family connection, we were given a private audience. And I must say, we asked him all sorts of questions. Found he was very pro-British, in spite of what the newspapers said that he was a Congresswaller. But having said that, the Congress used him because he was so popular with the whole populace. He was revered almost as a saint. And of course, he was, whilst being a very strong Indian, he didn't dislike the British at all. And in one time, as one of his early history, of course, he did a lot. He joined the nursing service in the First World War, or just before. And he was a funny man. He would have days, weeks of silence. He wouldn't talk to anybody. So when he did speak, people listened to what he had to say. He would go on starvation diets to make his point at times. But, as it transpired later, these starvation diets were always well laced with glucose and drinks and that sort of thing. That was, and Congress looked after him. He was a masterpiece on the side to have somebody like that who was a national hero. And Congress were not against violence themselves. Some of them were, but as I think, the non-violent movement was entirely Gandhi. And he used it not only to get score points of the British, but off right-wing politicians in India itself. Particularly, I'm referring to, of course, religion. At that time, the lowest classes of Indians were not even allowed to enter temples because they would defy the temple, defy all the temples. And he was greatly concerned about this and wanted the temples to be open to everybody. And the untouchables, as they were called, he called Harijans, which means children of God. He was a very good man, and I couldn't help but feeling after an hour or so with him that we'd been in the presence of a quite great man. It was riveting listening to him, and but it was something of his charisma that caught on too.
That must have been a wonderful meeting.
Yes, it was. We went up for an overnight journey by train from South India to where he was living in his ashram, the Sevagram, and we got there, and bus and bullock cart, and walked a bit, and we went back to caught the night train that day back to Madras.
Did you wear anything particular in his presence? I was thinking of his simplicity.
We did, because so as not to stick out like a sore thumb, we wore cutter white shirts, which were raw cotton, of course, and pajama trousers, baggy pajama trousers, which you could buy anywhere, of course. They were very comfortable in the center. In a hot climate, I don't know why we were all Alden wear these pajama trousers. We didn't wear the loincloths, which the Hindus wear. We wore the pajama trousers, which was, of course, worn primarily by Muslims. And the shirts, of course, worn outside the trousers. They're rather long tailed. They came down to the back of your knees at the back and just about your knee level in front. Very comfortable, very cool.
Yes, very attractive, I think, on men.
Yes, we didn't think so at that time. I felt rather like Charlie's, but we did not.
But I suppose
not to flatter, but not to stick out.
Yes, I suppose you did it out of respect as well, did you?
There was that in it, of course. Yes. It was a matter of respect.
You must also have seen something about the what one imagines is the very glamorous life in India for young army officers at the time, with the Maharajas, and one thinks of all the ceremonies that were going on. Did you have any part of that at all, Gavin?
Oh, yes, every year. My first experience was with the Norfolks, when we were invited to a garden party given by one of the small Maharajas close to Jhansi, which is in the central in the United Provinces, and we went there to because he put on a show. There were dancing girls and all that sort of thing, and it was a day show. We went out after lunch to this place, and in taxis and in the rental bus. It was just officers invited, and actually, on this particular occasion, very disappointed. We didn't want them quite exactly what we expected, which was a sort of Roman, with a sort of Arabian night scene, and the dancers were covered from head to foot with saris and gold bangles and whatnot. And of course, the Indian music is very alien to the Western ear until you get used to it. So it was interesting as an experience, but nothing exciting. And later on, of course, we saw all sorts of sides of Indian social life, but more particularly, perhaps after the war and after India got its independence, when I was still out there, got much closer contacts. But as far as the Maharajas are concerned, of course, we met many of the younger ones playing polo in international, no, not international, but in national tournaments. And we found that some of them had been educated at Eton or Harrow. You know, particularly I remember Jai Singh, the Maharaja of Jaipur, and the Maharaja of Cooch Behar, who related through marriages, who were good polo players, very westernized, very much playboy types. I mean, there was all that sort of thing. You carry officers, because polo was the big thing, meeting place for people like them and us, had the advantage. And yes, we've been invited into their houses. They were very kind to me when war broke out and I was posted to the Middle East. I went to Jaipur, I wrote to him, as a matter of fact, to Jai, as he was known, and I said, Jai, I'm very worried the Japs are overrunning Burma, they're trying to get into India, I'm being posted to the Middle East, I have a wife and two small sons. If the worst comes to the worst, would you take care of them for me? That was assuming that the Japanese hordes poured into India. And he said, of course, Gavin, I will. So, you know, it took care of a worry that was at the back of my mind. India's a big country, the Japs can't be all over it. And he could easily conceal the family in his vast state, and until things sorted themselves out.
When were you married, Gavin?
I was married in Madras on the 7th of November, 1941.
After war had started then?
After war had started, yes. In fact, I couldn't have married at that age if it hadn't been for the war. Army officers were not allowed to marry until they had at least 9 or 10 years' service. The main reasons from the regiment's point of view was that the regiment was a family, and the best way for the young officers to get to know each other well was as a family. We all dined in the mess, and we didn't need to have
Diversions.
Diversions,
yes.
Thank you very much. with having a wife and perhaps young children. And also, you didn't get a marriage allowance until you were 30. And so you had to live on your pay. Well, as it was, every bit of your pay was going into your polo ponies and your way of life and paying mess bills. Unless you had a whopping private means, you couldn't have it. Well, if you had the means, and there were some chaps who did, they didn't. The organization, the colonel at the top, did not want him living out of the regiment, away from the other officers. So if he wanted to be married, he had to find another part, branch of service or something of that sort, or relinquish his commission. So up till about 29 or 30. But when war broke out, all rules went to the side. Things didn't look bad, and you had to go to your serious end. I've met so and want love and all that. And I would like to get married, and you always got permission, which is why I got permission. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was an ADC to the Governor of Madras, and I was away from my regiment. I met so many, many beautiful girls and good families and all that sort of thing, and I'd fallen in love with one of them, and I wanted to marry her, and I wanted to have children before going off to war.
You were ADC then to Lord Erskine?
Lord Erskine, yes.
Yes, the Governor of Madras.
Governor of Madras.
Yes, what was that like, to be an ADC to someone like Lord Erskine?
Well, there was a lot of pomp and ceremony, of course. But pomp and ceremony in India go together. The Indian Maharajas used to live in their states, and they provided what Indians love, pomp and ceremony. And they would be, although they might be very poor themselves, they were very proud of their Maharajas because they put on a good show. And it was like going to, they were proud of them. He's richer than the next Maharaja. Of course, there would be a lot of, at these big functions, there would be a lot of charity given out. And some of them were very good to their people. They built schools and other things of that sort for them. Some of the states were larger than the whole of France. So they were administrators of huge areas with lots of people. And I never came across any examples, either in history or that I read, or personally, of people living in a state who didn't like their rulers. There was a lot of jealousy outside the state, especially amongst the part of India that was now occupied by the British, who wanted the British out, of course, but also saw the native rulers as a thorn in their flesh, because we were siding with them and they were siding with us, in a sense. In fact, many of the rulers owed their position to helping us at the time when we overran India and took over great parts of it. And it was through their help that we were able to do this. So there was wanted both ways of sorts.
What was your job as an ADC? What did this involve?
Well, the three presidencies, Madras, Bengal, and Bombay, were very important, and they were large presidencies. And there were four ADCs to each of the governors in those big divided parts of India. You were on a roster duty. On one day, the first day, for example, you would be on duty with His Excellency. I'll go into that in a moment. The second day, you were on duty with his wife, Her Excellency, taking care of all her things. The third day, you were in charge of all guests and functions of that sort. And the fourth day, you had off, which you mucked in and helped one of the others if necessary when there were a lot of guests or a lot of functions. Or you you couldn't go away, but you had a day off to go and ride or fish or beach comb or whatever you like to do. It was a very social life, but a very rigid life. In keeping with pomp and ceremony, we all had to wear gorgeous uniforms, especially big functions, and very glamorous uniforms and so on, that sort of thing. But outwardly, it looked a rather poncy sort of life, but it was not. It was a very disciplined, rigid life. Protocol was very important, and you did what you were told, and you kept your mouth shut, and you were discreet, and you were there in support and background to what was going on, which was necessary. With AT, of course, you were in full uniform the whole day, and the many guests that would come to Government House, they would have to be met and talked to and made comfortable until he could see them. This also included when he had to go away on visits, you had to accompany him. With Lady Marjorie, who also had many, many social duties, visiting hospitals and schools and things of that nature, factories, very much the same whole life as the royal family in England, you had to go with her, again, in uniform. When you were in ADC in charge of guests on your third day, of course, you were responsible for talking to them and sending notes, and do you want a car today, where do you want to go, is there anything I can arrange, and that sort of thing. You were sort of host for them. And the fourth day, you go on down to the beach and lie in the sun all day and do nothing you wanted to. But usually, of course, especially the busy times of the year, Christmas and that sort of thing, you would be there pitching in with the other four, helping wherever necessary, especially probably with the guests.
Was that a very prized position, a privileged position to be ADC to the governor?
It was a privileged position. It wasn't everybody's cup of tea. One thought of ADCs as rather effete, sort of gorgeously clad young men. It was only when I became an ADC that I realized it was not like that at all.
And Lord Erskine, what was he like to work for?
Extremely nice man. He was about my height. I was taller then. I've lost about 3 inches in the last 40 or 50 years. And he had a charming wife. We used to play snooker with him every evening after dinner, play golf with him in the afternoon on days when he didn't have much to do, play tennis with him. He was one of the boys. He was extremely nice. His wife, nobody could not like Erskine. His wife was charming. She was loved by all the servants, as well as by us. I'm talking platonically, of course. She was sweet, and she was nice looking, and very thoughtful, and very, funny enough, motherly, but she was also very pretty still. And she had four sons of her own. They were all at Eton, but they did come out once to Madras all together, and we saw them. They stayed for their long summer holidays. John, who became eventually, was then the master of Erskine, became Lord Erskine when his father died, and Robert, and Alistair, and David. Alistair, who was, his mother's favorite in a sense, was very good looking, joined a cavalry regiment, which of course by the in the war, which by then was mechanized, was unfortunately killed. The others survived. John had gone into the Scots Guards, Robert, but little David stayed with her mother, his mother. He was only 8 or 9 years of age when he was born. Their ages were, they fallen between 8 and 18, and he was in Madras until they went back to England.
End of Reel 2 and Reel 3, Gavin Douglas.